When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
One and all, and welcome to Book Off, the literary podcast with a difference. I'm your host, Joe Haddo, and it's great to have you with us wherever you are listening from. On this episode, I'm joined by two brilliant authors who'll be talking about their writing, their latest books, what they've been reading recently, and we'll be going head to head in a war of the words a little later on, pitching a book that they each absolutely love to us in the Book Off. My first guest was awarded the Scott Prize for her debut collection of short stories, and her first novel, A Song for Issy Bradley, was shortlisted for the Costa First Novel Award. Here to tell us about her latest book, When the Lights Go Out, it's Caris Bray. Hello!
Hello!
Thanks for joining us. And also joining us today is a lecturer, journalist, author, and a fellow judge of mine for the Costa Short Story Award, which we have done together for more years than I can remember now. Here to tell us about her second novel, How to Belong, it's Sarah Franklin. Hello.
Hello, Joe. So nice to be here with you both.
I always think of November as sort of our month, Sarah, because November is the time that you and I and three other judges, Kit Duval, Simon True and Adele Parks, sit down and judge the Costa Short Story Award, as I said. But of course, this month and this year, we're not going to be together in a room.
I know, it's really disappointing, isn't it? I think the judges' dinner is the happiest, one of the happiest bits of November, frankly, for the whole thing. It's just so much fun every year.
We do have a laugh, and you know, we're still going to be judging it, albeit virtually. And of course, we three would be in the same room together recording this podcast, were it not for COVID. So, Caris, where do we find you today?
I am in my office. That's in Southport, in Merseyside, where we've been in tier three now for some time. So
yes,
yeah, so that's where I am. I've got a beautiful view out of the window of everybody's trees shedding their leaves. So
that sort of makes tier three / the second lockdown a little bit better, doesn't it?
I'll take anything. Yeah, nice view, absolutely. Yeah.
And what about you, Sarah? Are you at home?
I'm at home, yet, so I'm on Google Maps. I'm exactly halfway between Oxford and London, which always makes me laugh quite a lot. And I'm in what we call the beach huts. My husband and I knocked down the garage 3 years ago and built these ridiculous bright blue beach huts instead, which have completely, like, all the people who mocked us for doing it at the time are now just really jealous because we have these purpose-built, you know, little offices out in the garden. So it's three steps to work for me, and I've never been happier to do it.
Wow. Yeah, that's amazing, isn't it? Not the 39 steps, the three steps to work. That's great.
No, exactly that. Yeah, that's perfect.
Yeah, so we're all in different places, of course, and the line may go a little squelchy on occasions, but we hope anyone listening will forgive us that. It's obviously really hard doing this with three tin cans and metres of string. So we will continue on as we have been doing all series. And you two already know each other, don't you? You're friends.
Yes, we are. We met on an Arvon course, actually, funnily enough.
And what is one of those when it's at home?
So we were both doing, what was it?
It was a finish your novel, which always made me laugh because I was so clearly so far from finishing my novel. But, you know. In 2013, Karen, yes. I was trying to remember. I think it was too.
I was trying to remember as well. And so it was a residential week, 5 days away, where we'd sort of gone to get some time to write. And there were some writers there who were, you know, doing workshops and reading our work. And Sarah and I met then, and Sarah befriended me.
You make it sound like you have no choice, which was probably true.
Well, Sarah is just one of the warmest, friendliest people I have ever met. And I have to say that at the weekend, I listened to the Belfast International Arts Festival, had a Zoom thing. I don't know how to describe it. But anyway, it was online, and Sarah Moss and Sebastian Barry were there. And Sebastian Barry said, and I paused the feed so I could write it down, "To be befriended is one of the great magnificences." And I'm not particularly assertive. I'm a bit of an introvert. I'm so glad Sarah befriended me, because it's, you know, we've been friends for 7 years. And yeah, it that was the best thing that came out of that writing course for me.
If we were in the same room at this point, I would be happy. Well, for everybody, that we don't have that. But I remember just thinking, you had this quality. You were just still and you listened, and then when you had something to say, everybody listened to it, because it was always so precise and so right. And I really, really envy those qualities in anybody, being still and being able to, you know, and saying the right thing.
Oh, thank you.
No, you know, just really aren't my core strengths. And I was like, this woman is so interesting. And there were a couple of things you said when you sort of ever so slightly contradicted yourself, and I thought, oh, there's more there. She's telling us what she wants us to know. And I just thought,
that's really frightening. That.
It's like she's been studying you, Paris.
But I've just made myself sound completely if only.
Well, I love how this, I love having friends on this podcast, because it always tests the friendship at the end when you go head to head and pitch a book against each other. We see the competitiveness come out of both of you. But I'm sure you will both be the best of friends when we finish. Before we get to the book off, though, we have to talk about your latest novels, which have just come out. And I've got both of these beautiful books in front of me. I'm looking out of my window here onto some trees. And actually, it's almost like they're a photo image of the front cover of How to Belong, which is this beautiful shot of the Forest of Dean, I imagine, Sarah, is it?
Fortunately, I'm not so much of a nerd that I can recognise tree by tree all of the Forest of Dean. But I think we should...
Why not?
I mean, although there are bits of it, honestly, that I've seen in photos and I've known it's the forest, which I think is a bit disturbing, really. But yeah, it's an absolutely gorgeous cover. And this is one of these... I think there are very few advantages to lockdown, but this book was due to come out in May. And when we decided it needed to move to November... Everybody was like, well, the cover is just going to be so perfect, frankly. You know, if nothing else, people will be drawn to it to have a bit of that gorgeous autumn in their house. So, yeah. It's absolutely beautiful.
Well, it is beautiful, and it absolutely is the right time for it. Not only because it's autumn now, but because I think so many of us are just sort of wishing to be outside, you know, and making sure that we are trying to get outside as much as possible. And actually... with both of these books, Carrie's with yours as well, you know, it really does make the reader want to be in nature a bit. And for your front cover, it's a very sort of different style, Carrie's, but still this, you know, this beautiful sea, albeit with a house floating in it. But like, it's very much nature-y as well, isn't it, in terms of the subject matter. So let's talk about When the Lights Go Out. It tells the story of a married couple, Emma and Chris. Could you tell us a little bit more about them and a little bit more about their situation?
Yes. So When the Lights Go Out, it's the story of Emma and Chris, and they've been married for some time, and they have an historically happy relationship. However, when we join them during a particularly wet winter, their relationship is becoming somewhat strained. Emma is preparing for Christmas, and Chris is fretting about starvation and societal collapse. He's turned off the heating. He's making his sons run across the moss, which is like some farmland where they live. And he's got other plans that Emma would definitely veto if he shared them with her. She really wants to try and rescue him from this sort of pit of worry that he's fallen into. But he doesn't want to be rescued. In fact, what he would really like is to pull her in after him. And I suppose it's a novel about coming to terms with our changing environment, but it's also a novel about the changing climate of a marriage. That's my sort of elevator pitch.
That's the elevator pitch. Very good it is too. And yet you're right. What I found so clever about the book, as well as enjoyable, is that it's I would call it a climate change novel. Is that fair?
Do you know, I think...
No, I don't know. Maybe that's into a corner. Yeah.
I think it's fair enough. I genuinely don't know. I think there are certain parameters, aren't there? I think people can get a bit upset about how novels are categorised and defined. I'm happy for anyone to define it however they like. So yes, climate change novel, absolutely fine by me.
But it's like you say, it's the sort of the change of the relationship climate between the two people, and it's also with the backdrop of this changing world that we live in. And you started writing it quite a number of years ago, didn't you? So I just wondered what sort of prompted it. Was it that you wanted to write about the environment, the world, or did you have the characters in mind first?
So I wanted to write about a marriage. And because my other novels, Song for Izzy Bradley, is very much about a family, and every member of that family has a sort of equal part in the story. And then The Museum of You, my second novel, is about the relationship between a father and a daughter. So this time I knew I wanted to write about a marriage. And I suppose I was interested in writing about climate change. I think back in 2016, I was concerned about fracking, which was supposed to be happening not too far from where I live. And I thought that I would take the issue of climate change and make that an issue in the relationship. And then obviously in 2016, we had Brexit, and followed by, you know, those elections that we had. And I noticed some of my friends felt very differently from their partners about Brexit and the subsequent elections, voted differently, and that had a really really big impact on relationships that sort of had lots of years in the bank, but that one thing made things really tricky. And so I climate change is the sort of wedge in the marriage. It's not a question of believing. It's not a novel about climate denial. It's a novel about how best to respond to climate change. That's where the difference between the characters lies, and Chris is very much in a sort of fight or flight mode, while Emma is just trying to keep everything going
and celebrate Christmas
and celebrate Christmas, which, you know, I suppose
we're all thinking about at the moment, aren't we?
Thinking about that. Absolutely. Do you know, the novel ends on, I mean, I never say what year it is, but there's always somebody who will work it out and work out if you've made a mistake, isn't there? So you do find out what day of the week it is and what date it is on a couple of occasions. And so the novel actually ends on Christmas Eve 2019. So I have been sort of excused from including any of our current misfortunes.
Yes, very good. Very good. Yeah. Sarah, I mentioned your beautiful front cover with this forest scene on it. And the book is filled with beautiful descriptions of forest life. And I just wondered, what was it that drew you to Forest of Dean particularly? And also, could you tell us a little bit more about Joe and Tessa and their story?
Sure. So the Forest of Dean, this book, it makes me laugh because I don't think that there's much forest in this book. And everybody who's read it is like, Sarah, the forest is everywhere in this book. which I think is, relatively speaking, absolutely true, but just compared with the amount of forest I might have put into it, perhaps less so. So I grew up in the Forest of Dean, and I haven't lived there for 30 odd years, but I'm really, really sort of passionate about telling its stories, because I was one of those kids who, you know, was always reading, always devouring things, and I'm not a sort of sci-fi or fantasy reader. I read to understand the world about me, and in the sort of 70s and 80s, books weren't really being written about rural places, and they certainly weren't being written about sort of, you know, ordinary rural lives in any real way. And when I wrote my first novel, that was set in the Forest of Dean as well, but it was historical. And what I really wanted to do, the Forest of Dean is just one of those places. It's really vibrant. Loads of people there do sort of really, really interesting things, but lots of people can't really accurately put it on a map, and its social mobility numbers are dire. And I thought, if I can just write a book for the kid that I was, or, you know, for the teenager and then adult that I was, that shows that, and this is going to sound more grandiose than I maybe mean it, but sort of show that those sorts of places, those tucked away rural places, are worth writing about, that things happen there that, you know, that are interesting and are relevant. And so with the book How to Belong, so it focuses on two characters, Joe and Tessa, who end up living together in Tessa's family's home. So Tessa's inherited this little cottage out in the middle of the forest near the small town, sort of the nearest place to them. And they've both grown up there, and they'd both sort of moved away for a part. Joe had gone off and become a barrister in London. She'd sort of done really well at school, and it had always been sort of obvious to her and everybody around her that if she was going to sort of fulfil her potential, she was going to need to leave the Forest of Dean and go out and, you know, find a way of learning more. She went off to university, she became a barrister, and she's been doing that for about 10 years, and it just doesn't do anything for her. She's sort of living at the end of a tube line and working on cases that don't make any sense or any real difference to people's lives, and she's just sort of more or less permanently homesick. And her parents have owned a family butcher shop, so it was her grandfather's before her parents took it over, so it's always been part of the community. And they decide that they've sort of had enough and they're going to retire down to the coast. And Jo can't bear the idea of this sort of family legacy, as she sees it, sort of leaving the family. So she persuades them to let her come down for 3 months and try it. You know, in her mind, she's moving and she's going to permanently become a butcher, and this will be marvellous. Leaving aside the fact that she's really, really squeamish, and even when she grew up there, she couldn't do anything useful at all around the butchering, and just sort of sat in the corner of the butcher shop reading her book while everyone else got on with it. And she's really excited about connecting with old friends, and she just feels life will have more meaning. She'll be part of a community and she'll be able to sort of do things. And she finds, really, without kind of giving away anything, that things change. You know, you change if you leave for the better part of, you know, a decade, 15 years, and sort of maybe romanticise whenever you come home. People are pleased to see you and you're sort of in and out for a tiny snapshot of life. But the people who've left have sort of grown and changed as well, and those relationships won't necessarily be as you've thought they will be. And Tessa's had a very different experience. So Tessa is a little bit older. She's in her 40s, and she's been somebody who has always found it hard to fit in anywhere. And she'd had a momentary chance at happiness, which she then kind of self-sabotaged almost because she felt she had to. And I think, again, without sort of giving too much away, Tessa has a condition that we find out about right at the beginning of the book, which means that if she exposes herself to emotion, then she goes into bodily collapse. So if she either allows herself or is around people who are happy or making jokes or angry or anything, then her body collapses. And so as a consequence, she's basically kind of lived this really, really isolated life. And suddenly this woman moves in with her. Tessa needs the rent. So Jo moves in, needing somewhere to live. And Jo's emotionally incontinent, basically. You know, all she can do is emote all the time. And so it's really about their relationship with the place. They're two very different relationships with the community, and also their relationship with each other and how they kind of both counteract and complement each other and help each other.
That's a fab description.
I'm never sure I can tell anybody what this book is about. That's the trouble. So, hopefully.
Well, and that's okay, I think. I think that's okay because, you know, Carrie sort of alluded to this earlier. It's like, you know, you can put a stamp on something like, oh, it's a climate change novel, but that doesn't necessarily mean anything. And it can also put people off, where actually, you know, both of these books are about relationships, they're about home, they're about nature, and I think they actually complement each other quite well. They're very different, but, you know, having read them in, you know, swift succession, it's actually a perfect match to have you both on together to talk about.
We know each other's books really, really well because we are each other's earliest readers, it's fair to say, isn't it, Caris? And so,
yeah. So do you share early manuscripts and things?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, we do. Absolutely. Yeah. We see the chapters that nobody should ever be allowed to see.
But that's that in itself is a very special relationship, I would say, isn't it?
Yeah, you have to trust somebody when you show them work that you know is not your, you know it's not your best work because it hasn't yet been edited and honed and improved, and so you have to trust the person who you show it to that they'll look at it and will know what your intentions were, and they also won't think, oh, you're rubbish. You know. So yeah, definitely, it's definitely a trust thing going on there.
And I think it's very important for writers. On a very recent episode of this podcast, Victoria Hislop and Lissa Evans were my guests, and they both said a sort of similar thing in that they, you know, when we're not in a global pandemic, they would spend a lot of their time at the London Library writing, and lunch breaks and things would come and sit, come together and just bounce ideas off each other, or, you know, talk about a paragraph they've written or a story strand, and just sort of use each other as sounding boards, really. And I think for authors, because it's such a solitary job, it's probably a really, really lovely thing. And not everyone has that. Not everyone has a Caris or a Sarah. That's quite nice, I imagine.
Yeah, I think it's, I mean, definitely. I feel extraordinarily sort of lucky to have, you know, and also someone who writes so beautifully, then sort of look and who understands what I'm trying to do and can sort of say, you know, Caris will sometimes say, is that what you mean? And because I know that she knows what I mean, really, you know, it's like having a brain outside your head looking at it. It's, you know, it's fantastic.
It's fun, yeah. And I imagine that stemmed from 2013 then, when you were both on this course. That's sort of why that's how this sort of trust has developed, isn't it? So that's brilliant. Yeah, I mean, both these books were just such a great read, and I really enjoyed, especially this time of year, sort of hunkering down and getting cosy and reading them. And they feel very much like not only books for now, as in the autumn, but they feel like, you know, especially yours, Caris, with the sort of climate change part of it, I do think it's a very sort of timely novel. And one thing I did think about when I was reading yours, Sarah, is that talking about women or a woman in a sort of job setting that you would often associate with a male, reading about the butcher shop and just thinking, oh yeah, and for it to sort of stand out to me a bit as like, oh, that would often be written as a son coming back to do that job, you know, to take on the family business.
I think I'm naturally contrary and also really, really drawn. So I come from a long line of people who are really, really smart, but also really good with their hands. So my grandfather was a carpenter, my sister's a nurse, you know, people who can make change through physical action, and I'm hopeless at it. So I'm really drawn to sort of describe things that I know I could never actually do. And so, you know, there's no way that I would be a half decent butcher. And Tessa is a farrier. And it's just, yeah, I think I'm really drawn to kind of big physical jobs that are supposed to belong to men. And just sort of say, well, but why? You know, why should they be? And, you know, out in the country, you would do the job that came to you. You know, it wouldn't necessarily be a... typically, I think the countryside can sometimes confound expectations like that because people just get on with the thing at hand, you know, a bit more. So I think that was, as I say, just sort of natural contrariness. And, you know, it's nice to write, you know, women doing these things, these surprising things.
Absolutely it is. It shouldn't be something that sticks out to me or a reader. But it did, you know, and that's because we've still, that's a long association of that sort of character and stuff. So it's, you know, it's just really refreshing, I thought. Now we're going to get to the book off very shortly. Before we do that and find out which books you're putting up against each other, I've been enjoying asking all of my guests what they've been reading recently and enjoying, because I think at this time when we're spending a lot more time at home, when because of second lockdown, independent bookshops and all bookshops and shops are sort of going to be needing our help however we can, I think it's quite good to get some book recommendations from our authors. So have you been in a reading mood, Caris? Is there anything recently that you would recommend that you've loved?
So I've been reading short novels. I didn't read very much at the beginning of lockdown because I just was slightly obsessed with like listening to the news and those sort of daily press conferences. And and what a waste of time.
Yeah, I think we all
were
a bit like that.
But yeah, so recently I've been reading short novels. So I've read The Days of Abandonment by Eleanor Ferrante. I've not read any of her stuff before. I read J.G. Ballard's The Drowned World, The Spare Room by Helen Garner, which I thought was incredible, An American Marriage by Teyari Jones.
Teyari Jones,
And I read a book called, well, actually the version I read was called The Emissary, but I think that's the American, I think I'd got hold of an American copy. It's actually called, in the British version, it's called The Last Children of Tokyo by Yoko Tawada. I probably murdered the pronunciation there, but which is a story about a novel about Japan. After it's a sort of post-apocalyptic novel, but you don't quite know what's happened or why. And all the old people are really strong. The main character that we're following, I think he's 110. And all the young people are being born frail and elderly. And yeah, it was very strange, but quite lovely in places as well. So yeah, I've been keeping my reading quite short because I'm trying to write a novella at the moment myself, so I'm trying to get myself into that whole, you know, 150 pages thing.
Get in the mindset, Carrie. Yeah. That's what you need to do.
That's
do you know what, I love a novella. I love a short book. I always say it, but I really do. So that's a great great list that you've come up with. What about you, Sarah? You've been reading much other than the Costa short stories, of course, which you and I have both been reading.
Quite a few short stories recently, Jo, as you know. None of which that I can really talk about, at least not in this forum, not yet.
Not
but
at the moment,
when they go
no.
to the public
and we place. Don't know who they're by anyway,
no,
do
that's
we?
That's true. So we could say there's an amazing story, no idea who wrote it. Super helpful. But yeah, so I went on an Anne Patchett streak during lockdown, which was Commonwealth was on my shelf for years, and I don't know, something put me off starting it. And then when I did, I was like, why have I never read any? And everybody around me said, we don't know why you've never read any Anne Patchett. Clearly you'd love her. And so at the beginning of lockdown, I read Bel Canto, which actually works really, really well. You know, if you're going to want to feel comforted by something, then actually reading about a hostage situation in which everybody from around the world is in the same situation and there's no real knowing what's going to happen and when it might end. Turns out, you know, it was the perfect lockdown reading in a bizarre sort of way. And I loved the way that, you know, there are all these different personalities in the room, so you see them reacting differently. And the opera singer who's been sort of taken hostage along with all the businessmen and sort of Anne Patchett's observations on what it's like to be the one woman in the room with, you know, all sorts of power. And I just think it's a really beautiful and funny book. And then I read sort of three or four others of hers afterwards, and I just love the way she picks these sort of slightly unusual characters and settings and makes them so wholly real and believable. So it's sort of escapism, and at the same time it isn't, because you know that this is absolutely how a human being would react in those situations. And then the other thing, so I don't generally, let alone right now, I don't sleep brilliantly because I'm just so excitable. So if I read fiction too close to bed, I end up having fever dreams about whatever's going on. So, you know, when I read State of Wonder, I was going down the jungle with Anne Patchett's figures all night, and that was exhausting. So I've always got non-fiction on the go as well. And my current non-fiction read, which I would wholly recommend to everybody, is called Because Internet. And the subtitle is Understanding How Language is Changing. It's written by a Canadian academic called Gretchen McCulloch, and she's a linguist, so she's a trained linguist and by, you know, profession, that's what she does, but she's also, she says, a person of the internet. And so she's written a book about what the internet is doing linguistically to the way that we speak, and, you know, sort of both on the internet but also the spillover off the internet. And it's just fascinating. So she's looking at, you know, Ryan Gosling memes and emojis and things, but she's also just looking at the fact that you'd have people, none of whom speak a common language, all nonetheless communicating about the same topic, you know, on Twitter or on Instagram or something, and what that's doing just collectively to our sense and understanding of language. I don't know, I mean, I'm a real sort of linguistics nerd anyway, so it really appeals to me, but it's just...
Oh, that sounds really good.
Yeah, it's really good. Yeah.
Really interesting. I do think Karis mentioned at the beginning of, you know, lockdown one in March, not being able to sort of read at all and being consumed by the news. I actually found that my way back into reading after the initial sort of desperation of it all was through nonfiction, and a book like that you're describing, Sarah, that would right now, that sounds like the perfect thing for me to have on the bedside table, you know, and just dip into.
Yeah, I mean, that's it. And it's not narrative, you know, it's not a sort of piece of narrative nonfiction per se. I mean, it's beautifully written, as you'd expect from a linguist, but you know, each chapter looks at a different thing, so you can just kind of find yourself halfway through something in the middle of the book without it making any, you know, enormous problems for yourself. So
yeah, great. Well, thank you for those recommendations.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
And it's time for the book off now, which is where you're going to recommend us each another book. This time, however, it's a little bit more formal because each of you is going to get 3 minutes on the clock in which to tell us about the books that you're putting forward. You don't have to use your 3 minutes if you don't want to or need to. But at the stroke of that 3 minute mark, if you're still talking, you're either going to be honked out or you're going to be rung out by the school bell. So we need to decide who goes first, who goes second, and we need to decide who's going to be honked and who is going to be rung. So Karis, would you like to go first or would you like to go second?
I would like to go first to get it over with.
get it done with. Very yes. Good. And Sarah, would you like to be honked out or rung out at your 3 minute time?
I would like to be honked out, please, because when's that ever going to happen again?
Honked! fantastic. Right, well, that means that you are going to be getting the school bell, Karis.
Excellent.
Before we hear you do your pitches, just tell us what book you're putting forward. So, Sarah, which one are you going for?
I've gone for Rebecca Mackay's The Great Believers.
And, Karis, what are you putting forward for us today?
Well, do you know, I was going to do All My Puny Sorrows, and I have been listening to the podcast, and I realised that that was done quite recently. So, and I thought, well, then I better
sorry
choose
about
something
that.
Different. I better choose something else. So, I am doing Jenny Erpenbeck's Visitation.
Fantastic. Well, I've put 3 minutes on the clock for you, Karis. We're going to stay stumm, and it's over to you to tell us all about Visitation.
So I came across this novella several years ago when I was teaching a really interesting module at Edgehill University that was called Reading the World, and it looked at literature and film in translation, and Visitation was one of the set texts. It's set on a patch of land next to a Brandenburg lake, and it tells the story, or the history, of a summer house that is built there. But it's also a political history of Germany from the 19th century to post-reunification. It opens with an amazing prologue describing the prehistoric forces that form the landscape on which the house will stand. It's basically 24,000 years of geological history in two pages, and it's really well written. And you know, sometimes you begin a book and you just think, yes. And that's how I felt as I read the prologue. It's the book is it's like a mosaic of stories and vignettes all linked to this property. At the end of the 19th century, there's Clara, the village mayor's daughter, who should have inherited the forest plot but loses her mind. There's the Jewish neighbour who sells his property to an architect for half its value as he flees the Nazis. There's a writer who moves in, returning from exile in Russia. And each story is followed by an encounter with a local gardener. And his routines and his stoicism and his patience, especially later as the property falls into decay, provide consistency and they ground the narrative. My favourite chapter is called The Girl, and it tells the story of Doris, a child who has summered at the house. But in this chapter, she's actually hiding from the Nazis in the Warsaw ghetto. And I think it might be one of the most beautifully understated yet powerful descriptions of a life and a death that I've ever read. It does work as an incredible short story. At the end of the novella, the house is demolished, and there's an epilogue outlining waste disposal according to legal guidelines. And how you make something like that sound beautiful and like it belongs in fiction is beyond me, but Erpenbeck manages to do it. It's a really short book. It's just 150 pages, and it's beautifully written. It's thought-provoking, and it makes me think about my own house, which is, I think, about 120 years old, and wonder what all the stories are that could be associated with the place where I live. And that's it. I'm done.
Fantastic. Oh, wow. You said I'm done. It was like you planned it. Lovely pitch, Karis. Thank you very much. And take a breather now. Right, you know what you're up against now, Franklin.
I know, I'm just like, follow that, Franklin. I don't think so. So unreasonable.
So we're putting 3 minutes back on the clock for you to tell us all about The Great Believers.
Great. So The Great Believers is going to sound like a miserable book. And so I have to start by saying it's not at all. It's one of the most joyous, life-affirming books that I have ever read, I think. And it's very broadly speaking about a group of friends, predominantly in 1980s Chicago. They're in their 20s and 30s, and it's about the impact of the emerging and then the kind of burgeoning AIDS crisis. The novel is told in two strands, so we have alternating chapters which are each in a different timeline. The primary timeline is the 1980s timeline, where we go from 1985 for a period of 7 years following the life of a young art gallery development officer called Yale Tishman and his group of friends as aid sort of comes upon this group. So they're all sort of living their lives. They're just really excited. And then right at the beginning of the novel, the first person in their friendship group dies, and you start to see how they all react so differently to death being among them. The 2015 strand is the other strand, and it's just a couple of weeks where we follow Fiona, who's the little sister of one of the guys who dies at the beginning of the book. And she's estranged from her adult daughter. She's gone to Paris to try to find her. And what we're seeing in Fiona's story is the impact of living with something like AIDS 30 years on. You know, what happens when you've basically been through effectively a war and everybody that you know has died amongst you, and how you find the strength and the hope to continue. This is a book that I've been giving, it was going to sound really cool, I've been giving this book to loads of friends during the pandemic because it's just beautiful, it's really funny, and it really, really does bring hope, I think, to all of us that there's something out there beyond this. The stories that Rebecca Maka has sort of, she's really researched what it would have been like to be in your 20s and 30s, sort of in Chicago, specifically at that time. One of the things I love about her is she's from Chicago, so she's really wanted to write about that. And there are things, so quite early on, there's a scene where they go for Thanksgiving dinner, and they're having a sort of lovely time with this, you know, logical family that they've created. And at the end of the dinner, one of them's a lawyer, and he brings out power of attorney forms and says, okay, you know, we have to decide who's going to look after each other. There's this brilliant subplot about a woman in her 80s who may or may not have been an artist muse, and who wants to gift these sort of priceless objects of art to Yale as well, to the art gallery. And sort of it's a way of showing him that people have been through these ravages of their friendships before and they've survived them.
Oh. Ooh. Always startles everyone when they're not expecting it. Sorry about that.
It was coming.
Yeah. Another fab pitch there, Sarah. Thank you for that. And you can have a breather now. Karis, I don't know of Visitation. I loved your description of it. I loved your description of the girl and how, you know, just this one chapter could be a, you know, a short story on its own. Sounds from you talking about it that it, for a 150-page novella, it must be absolutely rammed because there seems to be so much in it.
Yeah, it really is. It's quite dense. And what often would, I think, some of the students, because I was teaching the novel, some of them would find it a little bit off-putting initially. And when we got to the time where we would actually be discussing it for a couple of hours, it was always clear that a couple of people hadn't actually read it. So I would always read the last part of The Girl aloud because I thought nobody should get away without having part of this story, yeah. Which is wonderful. And then hopefully that would make them go, you know, go back to and open it and at least read that part and get it. But yeah, I think it's really, really lovely, and there's different kinds of writing in it as well, and there's some quite playful pieces of writing when we look at the story of Clara, the village mayor's daughter, who goes mad, and in fact she goes mad at the dinner table. It's where it becomes really clear that she's gone mad, when instead of eating her food she just smears it all over her face. And I actually don't think she's gone mad at all. I think it's like a protest because her life is so restricted. Anyway, but when we get to that chapter, there's all sorts of sort of funny and horrifying rules about what women must do. And there's these repeated phrases of women, you know, you may and you must and you may and you must. And it's almost like a sort of refrain, like a poetical refrain going through. I just think it's beautifully written and really interesting as well.
Yeah, I mean, it really sounds it. And you really sold it to us. So that's Visitation by Jenny Erkenbeck. And Sarah, I also don't know, I must admit, of Rebecca Mackay's novel, The Great Believers, but hearing you talk about it again, I'm really, really keen to read it. And I loved at the start, you did make the point of saying you thought the book was joyous and life-affirming, because obviously if you start talking about the subject matter straight away, we're all going to make assumptions that this is going to be a bit of a depressing novel. But actually you've described it well in that it's a hopeful novel, and that in a time like this, probably why you've been giving it to lots of friends, you know, we need to be reading about coming out of something and seeing the other side of it. I love the idea of 1980s Chicago. I love that sort of character of Fiona with the, you know, dealing with the impact of the AIDS crisis 30 years on. I just think, yeah, there's a lot in that book as well by the sounds of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely stunning. I think one of the things that I think Rebecca Mackay does so well in this book is that she makes you, she really draws you into this world with her characters. She's, you know, it's such a vivid characterization, and there's, you know, somebody who's the editor of the local gay magazine, and they're sort of having big fights about how much they should or shouldn't cover this, and details, you know, such as when the tests first come out, people don't know whether or not to go and have them because it could just be the government's way of keeping tabs on the gay community, because at this stage, you know, at the early in the early stages, President Reagan wasn't actually sort of publicly admitting that there was any kind of pandemic happening, because it was in such a specific community. And so you're drawn, and there are some really kind of silly, flirty characters in it who are there for light relief, but you just get to love them all. They're all so invested in each other's lives, and you become so invested in them. And then it turns into this terrible thing, because the sort of 80 strand covers 7 years, you know that they're not all going to make it out the other end. And in fact, even by the sort of by the end of the novel, if you were just to read the 80s strands, you wouldn't necessarily know that. But the Fiona's sort of section, you know, the 2015 section, casts some light on sort of the fates of some of these characters that you really have just grown to care about. And you feel so protective of them as well, I think, because they're just, they're vulnerable and they're hopeful. And you, it's as if you can see, you know, the herd of elephants coming over the hill towards them, and they haven't yet seen it yet, or they're trying to kind of dress them up in glitter. You know, they're very obsessed in this book by glitter all the time. I think it must be a kind of 80s Chicago thing. And it's just, you know, you just, I found myself really rooting for them. And it's one of those books, I've read it several times since it came out, and it's one of those books that really merits a rereading, because you, once you know what happened, although it's not a kind of mystery in that sense, you read it really differently knowing their fates than you do the first time round, you know, when you don't quite know what's going to happen to whom and how it's all going to pan out. So, and it's one of these books, you know, although it's about something that we probably all, you know, we all know about intellectually, it really made me feel how it might have been, you know, and hopefully sort of understand that time so much better as well, which I like that, you know.
I'm going to sabotage myself now and say it is a really good book. Because Sarah gave me a copy of it.
Of course I gave
Sarah pressed it into my hands a while ago, and I think it's a fantastic book. And there's a particular chapter in it that is that took my breath away.
Yeah, but there's a chapter that, yes, that's basically sort of detailing everything you might lose if you were to die. And at least I'm assuming that's the chapter for me that just makes me every time.
Yes, it is. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, you're right, Karis. You've absolutely sabotaged it. Well, look, I was enjoying thoroughly both of those pictures, and Visitation has been written down and is on the ever growing list of books that I have to go and check out. But do you know what? I am, based on that passionate pitch, I am going to take home The Great Believers.
Oh,
well done, Sarah.
How exciting.
You've won the book off. With a little help from Karis as well.
Absolutely. Well, I'm the presentation. It sounds amazing.
How to Belong by Sarah Franklin is out now. It's published by Zaffrey, and When the Lights Go Out by Karis Bray is also out now. That's published by Hutchinson. Thank you both so much for taking the time to join us today. Thank you for your recommendations, and hopefully in the not too distant future we'll be able to do this in person.
Oh, thank you so much, James.
I hope so.
It's been so lovely.
Thank you.